Les colloques du Collège de France.
C'est nous qui vous remercions, cher Michal, pour nous avoir montré un Foucault en inconnu des archives polonaises, qui montre déjà combien le socialisme réel, qui se voulait une société de contrôle, ne contrôlait pas grand-chose, en somme, sinon l'indiscipline, et surtout, au fond, de nous avoir donné à entendre une autre vertu du malentendu, qui est plutôt le contretemps, ici, puisque, avec cette inquiétude finale sur l'usage foucauldienne des concepts aujourd'hui avec des nouveaux pouvoirs qui ne semblent au fond exprimer que l'éloge de la force nue, cette idée du contretemps que je trouve absolument fascinante, que Foucault n'est pas exactement dans la Pologne dans laquelle il est contemporain, mais qu'on peut le lire après coup. Maintenant, évidemment, nous allons, pour terminer cette matinée, saisir un Foucault pleinement contemporain, mais de lieux autres, et nous avons donc le plaisir maintenant d'écouter Bernard Harcourt. Bernard Harcourt est directeur d'études à l'EHESS, professeur à Columbia, où il est également professeur associé au département d'études afro-américaines, et il a également enseigné à Harvard, Chicago, NYU et Princeton. Précisons qu'en tant qu'avocat, vous êtes également engagé dans la défense de personnes condamnées à mort ou à la prison à vie en Alabama, ainsi que dans d'autres affaires liées au droit civil et humain. Vous avez publié de nombreux livres. Votre dernier paru en français aux éditions de la Maison des sciences de l'homme, le coopérisme, une théorie politique, économique et sociale. Signalons également au Seuil en 2020 la société d'exposition, désir et désobéissance à l'ère numérique. Et vous êtes l'éditeur de cours de Foucault au Collège de France, la société punitive en 2013, théorie et institutions pénales en 2015 et plus récemment, 2024, toujours dans la collection Hautes études, Nietzsche, cours, conférences et travaux. Nous vous écoutons pour une conférence sur le rapport entre Foucault, la prison et l'abolitionnisme.
Merci infiniment Patrick Boucheron, merci Didier Fassin et merci à vous tous. Revolutionary cycles, chain reactions, dialectical motion. What is remarkable about prison writings, writings from the prison, writings about the prison, is how the written word circulates in prison and recirculates. How the written words spark, inspire, nourish, and sustain cycles of change. How they break down walls and jump beyond borders. How they lead not just to interpreting the world, but to changing it. The prison writings of George Jackson stirred Michel Foucault. The moment he read them, Foucault and his colleagues and friends, Jean Genet, Daniel Defferre, and the other members of the Groupe d'Information sur les Prisons, the Prisons Information Group, what we call the JIP, in 1971. Jackson's writings propelled the JIP to action, fueling the flames of a broad-based prison abolitionist movement in France and elsewhere that was marked by prison riots and uprisings in France and elsewhere. The JIP understood well the stakes of the conflict. In their words, Jackson has already said it. What is happening in the prisons is war, a war having other fronts in the black ghettos, the army, and the courts. Today, the imprisoned revolutionary militants and the common law prisoners who became revolutionaries specifically during their detention are paving the way for the war front to extend inside the prisons. The JIP would conduct what it called inquiries intolerable inquiries into prison conditions and publish its findings and surveys in short books under the title Intolérable, Intolerable. And so, on November 10, 1971, less than 3 months after the homicide of George Jackson, the JIP published a 64-page pamphlet called The Assassination of George Jackson, with a preface by Jean Genet, two translations of interviews with George Jackson, and three essays, including the essay L'Assassinat Camouflé, The Masked Assassination, written by Foucault, Catherine von Bülow, and Daniel Defer. The book was edited at the leading French publishing house, Gallimard. The book takes a militant and critical position. On the back side, it declares, the death of George Jackson is not just an accident that occurred in prison, it's a political assassination. In America, the assassination has become and remains today a mode of political action. Jean Genet opens the tract with his preface with these powerful words. It's becoming increasingly rare in Europe for a person to be willing to die for the ideas they believe in. Black people in America do this every day. And while Foucault, Genet, von Bülow, Defer, Gilles Deleuze, Jacques Donzelot, Jacques Rancière, Daniel Rancière, and many others were conducting these intolerable inquiries, publishing prison writings, exposing prison conditions. Foucault, of course, was writing his great book on the prisons, Discipline and Punish. George Jackson's writings impacted Foucault's, pushing Foucault to turn his attention to war as a matrix to understand social struggles and relations of power. The model of war, which we see so clearly in George Jackson's writings, becomes, for Foucault, in his words, the matrix of all power struggles, of all strategies of power, and consequently, also the matrix of all struggles concerning and against power. In October 1968, already, Foucault was moved by the text of the Black Panthers. Reading them, immediately he'd write to Daniel Defer that, quote, they are developing a strategic analysis that breaks free from the Marxist social theory. By that, Foucault meant that their social theory was not only about class conflict, but about a wider conception of war. And only a few years later, Foucault would explicitly embrace the study of civil war as a matrix for social relations, writing to Daniel Defer on December 1972, telling him he was beginning to analyze power relations on the basis of, quote, what he wrote, the most reviled of all wars, neither Hobbes nor Clausewitz nor class struggle, but civil war. Jackson's writings and his life and the encounter with the Black Panthers had this transformative effect on the critical theory and praxis of Foucault, Genet, and the members of the JIP during the early 1970s. And of course, Foucault's book, Discipline and Punish, would then serve to rejuvenate other struggles and would eventually be read, debated, critiqued, torn up, and passed through the vents and cracks of solitary cells in prisons around the world, in California, 35 years later, and contribute to prison uprisings. What happened with the Short Corridor Collective, which was formed in the security housing unit at Pelican Bay State Prison in California, reflects this regenerative cycle. The Short Corridor Collective was created by men held in solitary confinement for being alleged leaders of different racially identified prison gangs. These included Todd Ashker, Arturo Castellanos, Antonio Guillen, Sitawa Jama, Paul Redd, and others. As the legal scholar Allegra McLeod recounts, the men could not meet face to face or even see one another from their solitary cells. But miraculously, they found ways to pass torn pages of books Michel Foucault, Surveiller et Punir, George Jackson, Frantz Fanon, Bobby Sands, Eldridge Cleaver, Assata Shakur, Howard Zinn. They would tear the pages and pass them through the vents and cracks of their solitary cells, under the cell doors, through zip lines, shooting into other people's cells. And they managed to debate and critique the writings and envisage new ways to understand their own incarceration and to develop new practices of resistance. By means of these readings and discussions, the collective formulated an understanding of their situation, of the ways in which the prison administration was using their racial identities to control them. And it was a journey that ultimately led them to initiate the country's largest ever prison hunger strike in 2013, involving more than 30,000 women and men throughout the California prison system who refused to eat. The hunger strike and the aggressive litigation ultimately led to California's agreement to end indeterminate solitary confinement based on gang affiliation. This reflects, in a way, the writings on the prison and the writings in the prison, the study that is done in prison, which so many of you who I can see who have worked in the prison have experienced. There is a way in which prison writings reverberate for the reader in the prison cells. Books are a transformative experience. Scene one, George Jackson. Jackson himself was transformed by prison writings. It was both what sustained and transformed him. I met Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, Engels, and Mao when I entered prison, and they redeemed me. For the first 4 years, I studied nothing but economics and military ideas. I met black guerrillas. These encounters would transform Jackson and his prison comrades into the military wing of the vanguard party, the Black Panthers. And he explained how he would be sitting in a cell, sometimes even with the lock welded shut, and there would be no one to talk to, he writes, just the sound of screaming voices. And because there's no human contact, you depend on books. No contact with people. Special lock welded on the door. Nobody around. I'm strictly by myself. The only friend I have is a book. Sometimes I find myself talking out loud to the author. I'd sort of wake myself up and I'd hear myself talking to this other person. I guess it was like some kind of wish fulfillment. When I'm asleep at night, I still find myself talking to those guys. Those guys, George Jackson would list them. Kwame Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, Marx, Mao, Lenin, Trotsky, the other Black Panthers, all revolutionary philosophers. They led Jackson, or rather he led them, on an individual journey along the path of politicization, of consciousness, of self-transformations, and the cycle would begin. One could almost hear in this cycle the sound of the carcelaras, the Roma prison songs. There are 25 cells in the Utrera prison. I've already tried 24. The darkest one remains for me. Scene two, Albert Woodfox. Falsely accused of killing a guard, Albert Woodfox was locked in solitary confinement for over 4 decades. He is known as one of the Angola Three, ultimately released in 2016 with the help of a brilliant, dedicated attorney, George Kendall, and his associates. Woodfox was incarcerated at the Angola Prison, the infamous prison plantation in Louisiana, built on the site of the Angola slave plantations, which are 28 square miles of prison. In his cell, Albert Woodfox began reading. This is from his stunning autobiography, Solitary, Unbroken by 4 decades in Solitary Confinement, published in 2019. I turned my cell into a university, a hall of debate, a law school. Reading was my salvation. I first gravitated to books and authors that dealt with politics and race. We read anything we could find on slavery, communism, socialism, Marxism, leaning against my wall in the cell, sitting on the floor, on my bed, or at my table. I read. Through prison reading, Woodfox came to see how the prison conditions at Angola replicated forms of slavery, how strip searches, for instance, were forms of humiliation and domination. He became a Black Panther at Angola and founded, along with Herman Wallace, the first official chapter of the Panthers Behind Bars. I could lose myself in a book, he writes. Reading the works of revolutionary thinkers moved Woodfox to political action, helped him survive 4 decades of the most torturous conditions of solitary confinement known to humanity. Scene 3, A New Generation. Today, a person confined to death row reads Adelbert Woodfox's memoirs, Solitary, and is rejuvenated in his struggle against the oppression of his confinement and sentence of death. He writes to Albert Woodfox's attorney, George Kendall, to send a message to Mr. Woodfox. It's a handwritten letter from death row, dated December 9, 2021. I've made some slight edits to conceal the identity. The letter is first addressed to George Kendall, expressing his deep appreciation and telling George about his own struggle for justice and his acts of resistance. First, let me express my deep appreciation for the work that you have done and continue to do. I've been familiar with your work for a long time, but I only learned of the depth of your involvement in the Albert Woodfox case in reading his book, Solitary, which I just finished. I have been heavily involved in prison rights and education and criminal justice reform for almost 2 decades, he writes. And then he asks George to share a letter with Albert Woodfox. OG, that was the name. Shaka Sinkwe was the name that Woodfox had taken in prison. I myself and some other socio-politically conscious comrades have been having teach-in sessions with your book, Solitary, here on death row. It's deeply inspiring and motivational, and we want you to know this. An idea that just came to mind, I'll skip it so that to retain identity. You will be able to see a video of me conducting a demonstration on the 35th anniversary of the assassination of George Jackson. Just know that there are brothers down here who stand in that righteous tradition, and we are still fighting on. Albert Woodfox's writings inspired him in a generative, revolutionary cycle of prison study. Teach-in sessions, reading groups, Jackson, Woodfox, and on and on. We are fighting on. The cycles revolve, creating these experiences, books as experiences. What's so striking about prison writing and writing on prison is their depth, the thrownness of the written words. The words emerge from the depths, de profundis, as Oscar Wilde titled his own prison writings. Jackson wrote from those depths. Jean Genet immediately sensed it. Genet himself had been imprisoned as a youth at the infamous juvenile facility, Mitre, the institution at the very heart of Foucault's Discipline and Punish. He would serve in the Foreign Legion too, another carceral space, and do stints as an adult in prison. It's no surprise that Genet was so taken by George Jackson's writings and by the revolutionary enterprise of the Black Liberation. He could feel, he could tell, the texture of the prison writings. As you know, Genet wrote the introduction to the French edition of Les Frères de Soledad, the Soledad Brothers, and he became a fellow traveler of the Black Panthers, spending several months illegally in the United States, publicizing and raising money for the Panthers. He writes on the last page of his introduction of his first encounter with Jackson's words. I lived in prison for too long not to have recognized, as soon as the first pages were translated for me in San Francisco, the unique scent and texture of something written in a prison cell behind walls with guards poisoned by hate. Yes, prison writings
writings on prison have a touch, a texture, a color that speaks, like those of Nelson Mandela from Robben Island, like those of Antonio Gramsci in the prison notebooks, like those of Tony Negri, writing from prison in Italy, or like those from Angela Davis, writing from the Marin County Jail. Speaking of which, Angela Davis, of course, well, writings on prisons also have theoretical and practical implications, and they fuel abolitionism. What Angela Davis's genealogy of the prison revealed is that the institution itself was founded alongside a reformist discourse, that those two elements, the penitentiary and its reform, underpin the entire history of the prison and perpetuate the institution. From the very beginning, the prison has always been considered imperfect, deficient, and in need of reform. And it is precisely on this point that Angela Davis opens her abolitionist book, Are Prisons Obsolete? Davis writes, "It is ironic that the prison itself was the product of concerted efforts by reformers to create a better system of punishment. If the words prison reform so easily slip from our lips, it is because prison and reform have been inextricably linked since the beginning of the use of imprisonment as the main means of punishing those who violate social norms." Davis uses, as the epigraph to her analysis, the specific passage from Discipline and Punish where Foucault writes about prison reforms. This is Foucault writing. "One should recall that the movement to reform prisons and regulate their operations is not a recent phenomenon. It does not even seem to have originated in a recognition of failure. Prison reform is virtually contemporary with the prison itself. It constitutes, as it were, its program." Prison reform is the very essence of the prison system. In Discipline and Punish, Foucault goes on to write after this passage, "From the outset, the prison was caught up in a series of accompanying mechanisms whose purpose was apparently to correct it, but which seemed to form part of its very functioning, so closely have they been bound up with its existence throughout its long history. There was at once a prolix technology of the prison. There were inquiries. There were societies for supervising the functioning of the prisons and for suggesting improvements. There were programs drawn up to improve the functioning of the machine prison. The prison should not be seen as an inert institution shaken at intervals by reform movements. The theory of the prison was itself constantly set as operational instructions rather than its incident criticism, one of its conditions of functioning." Seeking to reform the prison today, on my reading of Foucault, would only serve to sustain the institution and prolong its lifespan. It could only work in favor of its very existence, operation, replication. The prison, as Foucault demonstrated, is an institution in constant need of reform that thrives and survives precisely because of reformist discourse. Foucault sought to shatter the institution without a roadmap for what comes next, without a program. In this regard, I agree with Amy Allen, who argues that Foucault offered, quote, "the possibility and opportunity for radical social change with an open conception of the future." When I reread Foucault's genealogy of the prison, when I examine the work he carried out with the Jeep, when I review the intolerable leaflets they published, when I explore his lectures on the punitive society, I have no doubt that his genealogical work was not oriented towards reform, but towards radical social change. This work was normative from start to finish and radical. It is no coincidence that so many thinkers, particularly so many liberal thinkers, regard Foucault and Nietzsche as so dangerous, perhaps the most dangerous philosophers of all. Their genealogical methods and their philosophical work were radical. And vice versa. Practice feeds into theory. Foucault visited Attica Prison in New York State in 1973, April. That was the prison where riots had broken out about 8 months earlier, in September 1971. The visit left a deep impression on him and transformed his understanding of the prison. It was an experience that he described as shocking. Shaken and, in his words, disconcerted by this visit, Foucault began an analytical shift in 1972 toward the positive functions of the penal system. Quote, "The question I am now asking myself is the opposite," he says, the opposite of what he had been studying in Théorie Institution Pénale, which was the kind of positive version of repression. It was in 1972 in Théorie Institution Pénale. It was a repressive theory that he was studying. "The question I am now asking myself is the opposite," he says. "The problem then is to determine what role capitalist society assigns to its penal system, what its intended goal is, and what effects all these procedures of punishment and exclusion produce. What is their place in the economic process? What is their significance in the maintenance and exercise of power? What is their role in the class struggle?" And of course, you can hear at that time a much more Marxisant Foucault. Scene 4. Today still. In September 2024, I receive a letter from a dear friend, a classmate, a colleague, incarcerated in a prison in an authoritarian country in the Middle East. At the time they were writing to me, in September 2024, they had been incarcerated for 383 days. As they explained to me in their letter, quote, "I can tell you the exact number of days because I have my calendar in front of me, written by hand, on which unfortunately I have not stopped adding new months since I began." Their conditions of confinement were horrendous and scary. I cannot enter into details in order to ensure the anonymity and safety. What has given them solace, though, what has saved them, what has given them strength to resist, are books. They write. "Last night I was reading Eribon's biography of Foucault and the Prison Information Group booklet, and this sentence struck me. They tell us that the system of justice is overwhelmed. That is easy to see. But what if the police are the ones who overwhelmed it? They tell us that the prisons are overcrowded. But what if the population is overprisoned?" Prison reading, prison study, it sustains, keeps people alive to fight back and to fight on. Quote, "I surrender as the first precondition to then fight back." Another regenerative cycle. The experience of prison transforms. Foucault understood this well. He spoke about how his own experiences of writing books transformed him. When he was writing a book, he explained, he aimed at having an experience himself, he said. "An experience is something that leaves you transformed. Writing a book transforms me and transforms my thinking. Each book transforms what I thought when I finished the previous one. I am an experimenter, not a theorist," he wrote. "I am an experimenter in the sense that I write to change myself and no longer think the same way I did before." Foucault's position on this was stark. What matters about writing a book is the experience. The truth or falsity, those are very simple matters. Facts can be checked The real ambition, the ultimate achievement, is to create an experience that is transformative for the reader, an interpretation of facts that moves the reader. I have seen this with my own eyes, how books change people in prison. I observed their unique power to inspire reflection, to stimulate acts of resistance, to open up spaces of freedom. Last scene. On a Friday afternoon, I surrendered Terry on an outstanding felony warrant to the criminal court down at 100 Center Street in Manhattan. He'd been out in and out of Rikers and was wanted on two felonies. It was an utter mess. The NYPD were looking for him in New York City. Federal marshals were looking for him as well. He was in contempt of court. The assistant attorney, district attorney, wanted 9 years of hard time in prison, and the judge was furious as well. We were fortunate enough to stall the sentencing, and Terry was sent off to Rikers Island. But when he was remanded to Rikers, he turned to me and looked at me, and while he was walking off in custody, I saw his face and how worried he was, and I was crushed. And what he was most worried about was that they were going to take his book. He had to review this book for a national newspaper, and he wasn't sure that they were going to allow him to keep it through the processing at the courthouse and at Rikers. I kept worrying it as I left the courthouse without him that afternoon, wondering if he'd be able to keep the book or if some correctional officer had confiscated it or put it in storage with the rest of his free world property. Terry stayed in touch over the months, communicating through a friend. He was actually able to retain the book, turned out, and write the book review from his dorm bed on the island. His friend transcribed his written writings, sent them on to the editor, and his review was published a few months later in USA Today, a leading US paper, while he was still locked up at Rikers. Back at court 6 months later, of course, I was just as worried in terms of his sentencing. Fortunately, though, we were in the alternatives to incarceration courtroom, and it made a great difference. The whole affair, start to finish, lasted about 15 minutes, and Terry was sentenced to a split sentence, 6 months time served, 6 months probation, remanded to a drug treatment program in the Queens. The court clerk and attorneys were spending some time figuring out where he could be released and whether they needed to return him to Rikers first. It was a mess, as usual. How he was going to get to Queens was totally unclear. Ultimately, everyone agreed that I'd actually drive him directly by car, no stops, as if he were in my custody. Court officials told me that he'd be downstairs in about half an hour. It was soon now 1:30, 2 p.m., 2:30, then 3 p.m. Eventually, I found him sitting on a bench near the elevators. He was sitting with his belongings, two large, clear plastic bags, 50-gallon bags, true jail issue, transparent, these big, clear plastic bags, heavy-looking, on the floor by his feet, filled with books. There must have been 70 or 80 books in there, plus the book under his arm that he was reading, a fat one. That one was called The New Negro, The Life of Alan Locke by Jeffrey Stewart. And among them all, naturally, Foucault's Discipline and Punish. He had a pair of beige jumpsuit slacks, still with the creases and the folds in them, state issue, and a white crew neck sweatshirt and his white tennis shoes. He looked straight out of jail. He was straight out of jail with his two huge bags of books. I picked up one of the books, he picked up the other, and we started heading out. We walked down the street quickly, trying to get away from the courthouse and the jail as fast as possible, trying to go away from the cops and the deputies. And we carried on. I carried one book over my shoulder, Terry carried the other. Books matter to Terry, words matter to him. The Blue 1619 Project was on full display. Another book on how we are an African people peered through the transparent plastic. He told me he had to leave a bunch of books at Rikers. He couldn't take them all. He told me he left them in good hands. I'm sure he did. So let me close. Oscar Wilde spent time at the Reading Jail, you will recall, 2 years of incarceration for the crime of homosexuality. Wilde was deeply affected while he was there by the execution of a fellow prisoner. Wilde wrote a ballad on the hanging called The Ballad of Reading Jail when he was released. He signed it C33. That was his prison number. And so it appeared originally anonymously. I will close with the final verses from Oscar Wilde's poem. I know not whether laws be right or whether laws be wrong. All that we know who lie in jail is that the wall is strong, and that each day is like a year whose days are long. But this I know, that every law that man made for men, since first man took his brother's life, and the sad world began, but straws the wheat and saves the chaff with a most evil fan. This too I know, and wise it were if each could know the same, that every prison that men build is built with bricks of shame and bound with bars, lest Christ should see how men their brothers maim. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.